Welcome to you people, and the title of this section is Stop, Look, Listen, The Arts as Religious Experience. Our panelists are all people who are involved and committed and working on the front end of things in the arts. We are not art historians, nor are we social scientists, but we experience our involvement in the arts as profound and uplifting and valuable, and invite you to consider with us the possibility that of art as a religious experience. Our panelists, whom I will introduce to you now, and they will speak in the order in which they're introduced, are first Bruce Bishop. Bruce is a bountiful physician, and I first met him in the music building at the University of Utah taking a music class, and we asked each other, as non-traditional students do, you know, what are you doing here? And he gave me such an interesting answer. I think he'll probably be more aware of it after he speaks, of his interest in getting more of the wonderful feelings of art that were so similar to him with the wonderful spiritual feelings that he found in his religion, and we have been friends ever since. Shauna Klinger is a young, gifted portrait artist, and her painting of Joseph Fielding Smith in the new Art and History Museum is a must-see. It is truly stunning. Marianne McMurray is a very sensitive poet, and I put down on the program that she was a humorist, and she told me she's not a humorist, but I will take that back then and say that she is a delightful person to be around, and she makes me laugh. Art Pett is another old-time friend of mine. We went to high school together. He received his education, grew up here in Salt Lake, and went to the University of Utah and has his architecture training from University of Pennsylvania. And I've always admired him for his intellect and his sensitivity. Dr. David Egli, who unfortunately will not be with us this morning, was included on the program before he found out that he would have to be away. But we met as a panel group about a month ago, and Dr. Egli was there, and I'm sure that you will hear many of his fine ideas in the remarks of everyone this morning, and he really wished that he could have been here, but it was just impossible for him to be in two places at one time. My name is Helen Stringham, and I will be the moderator, and I will use that prerogative to speak last, and then we are very interested in your remarks and your questions and your input into this idea. Our prepared remarks will be relatively brief because of this interest that we have. And I've also invited our panelists to participate in this question and answer period. So we'll begin by hearing from Bruce.
Have to talk on this subject. About 3 weeks ago, I asked my Sunday school class, gospel doctrine class, to define for me, in the best words they could, what they would label as a religious experience, what they would define their feelings as. If they could, in any way, walking out of a testimony meeting or having a spiritual experience, how they would define that. And these are the terms that I got from my Sunday school class. There were feelings of peace, of calm, of joy, humility, feelings for compassion for others, feelings for a desire to sing, to shout, to run, and feelings to weep. Some people expressed a burning feeling, goosebumps. Some others express the feelings of being edified with a desire to live a better life, to spill out themselves for other people. some expressed a feeling that they were satisfied that they understood another person. And after we had discussed that and had people try to define their religious experience in those terms, I then asked the people in the same class who had had similar experiences in the arts, whether they were the creator of an art, whether they were a composer or an artist, or whether they were a participant in the sense of sitting and listening to music or seeing a piece of art. If their experience in being edified was any different, if they could use any other terms in defining their experience by listening to a good symphony, and if that was different from their spiritual experience of coming out of a testimony meeting. And of all those in the class, none could make any differentiation between the two experiences. Now I'll come back and come to those particular definitions at the end of my discussion. My premise is that in the DNC, in general, there are two ways that Mormons get spiritual experiences. They get this definition that I've started with. There's one way, which I label as a vertical experience. And this experience comes where people think, they ponder, they wonder, they use their left brain. They try to figure out something, some question that they have in their life. And as they wonder about it, all of a sudden they move over into a right brain experience. They get spiritual insight, and they label it as spiritual insight. And it goes back to the original definition that I put. They get goosebumps, they get some feeling of satisfaction. I think the best example in the DNC that happens is the 138th section of the DNC. If you go back and read Joseph F. Smith's experience, before he received that section, he writes, "I was pondering, I was wondering about the questions of the hereafter." He was having a left brain experience. And then it broke open to a right brain experience where he had this wonderful vision. It's the same thing that's in the 8th and 9th section of the DNC, where you wonder about things and you try to figure it out, and then you supposedly get a burning in the bosom that it is correct. As a matter of fact, if you go through the DNC in general, most of those revelations were given because Joseph Smith was pondering, he was wondering about it, he was trying to figure out answers, and then he broke through and had this elevated right brain experience. Anybody that has had, I think, a testimony or a feeling that Jesus Christ is the Son of God has had, I think, this type of experience, where they have wondered, read, and tried to figure out what the life of Jesus Christ is about, prayed about it, and then received some type of spiritual experience. So my first premise is that we have this vertical experience going from a left brain experience up into a right brain experience. Now, I think also in the DNC, there is expressed in general a horizontal experience where people come together on the same plane. In the 50th section of the DNC, which was given to Joseph Smith because while he was in Kirtland, everybody was having revelations in church. People would stand up and have revelations and prophesy. And people came to Joseph Smith and said, "Hey, how do we figure out what's the good stuff and what's the bad stuff?" And Joseph Smith received the 50th section of the DNC, and that section essentially says this, that when the preacher comes, or when the person that's going to deliver the message comes, he should come with the Spirit. And that the person that receives should also come with the Spirit. And then the two meet together, and they together are edified. It's a horizontal plane. One delivers something, and if there's somebody out there, they will receive it. I think that in Mormondom, the best example I can give of that is a typical testimony meeting. Now, you might run through a lot of testimonies, but at some particular time, somebody's going to come up there and stand with the Spirit, and they're going to deliver something, and if people are in the room and are in a position to receive that Spirit, the two are edified, and what happens to them is the things that I started out with. They have goosebumps, they have some type of edification, they have a feeling that they have communicated with each other. Now, my assumption is that exactly that same thing happens in the arts. First of all, there is a vertical experience that happens, that people that are in the arts, usually an individual, uses left brain. He figures out something that is happening. They learn their art. A musician goes and learns the theory of music. and they learn all the technical terms, they learn how to put notes together, and then they think about that, and they try to put that together, and they might have some idea that then breaks them loose to create something. My example in that area is Claude Debussy. When he went to the Conservatory of Music in Paris, what he learned was classical theology, classical theory of music. And in that, he learned the classics of how to put together the theory of the classical production of music. But then what he did was, he got out of the conservatory and used that theory to break loose into a right brain experience and created the beautiful music of Impressionism. I think generally this vertical experience happens as an individual works in the his or her particular art and then comes and has the right brain experience. Now, I think also the horizontal experience happens in the art. It usually happens in somebody creating something, somebody coming and participating in that creation. I don't know how many of you go to the symphony, but since I do, that's the one experience I want to talk about. I'll go to the symphony, and I'll go through maybe five or six sessions, and I don't feel anything at all. And then something happens that is just so elevating to me. I walk out, and the experience that I have in that particular experience is no different than maybe listening to a 12-year-old kid give a neat little testimony or story about his feelings about his mother. Exactly the same experience happens to me. I walk out and I say, yeah, I'm going to go home and try to be a better father. I'm going to try to be a better person. I'm elevated by it. I remember in the Tabernacle several years ago when they played Mahler's Symphony of a Thousand, and they had both orchestras and the two choirs up there and sat back at the back over on the right side. I was really surprised the ceiling of the Tabernacle didn't crack. I thought angels were going to come down, and I was disappointed that angels didn't come down. I said to myself, hey, wait a minute, maybe somebody didn't get the message up there. It was such a wonderful spiritual experience for me. My proposition then is that exactly the same experiences that we get in Mormondom and we label as religious experiences and define those happen to people in the art, whether they are the creator of the art or whether they are the participant in the art. My conclusion is this. Waldemar Reed, who many of you know is a philosopher at the University of Utah, said he thinks the artist has increased free agency. And the reason the artist has increased free agency is because they have created something that nobody else has. They have experienced something that nobody else has. They have broken loose and been able to be more free by creating something new. I think as participants that we do the same thing. If we can feel something or understand the feelings of somebody else, we also are more free. John Taylor said, the Mormon Church will have a music of its own of the Hebraic order, and inspired with prophetic themes, and hence, like as in the Catholic Church, it will be universally cultivated as the highest branch of art, and in this, in time, will give birth among our people to great singers and composers. Well, that hasn't happened yet. I hope that in the future it will happen. I think that if my proposition is correct, that we ought to use the arts to intensify our own spiritual experiences, that they can be compatible in being able to intensify and have each individual have a greater spiritual experience. I don't think the religion should serve the art. I think the art should serve religion. I think that if Mormonism takes their proper place, that it is their turn to take our feelings about a deity and express it through art, just like Catholicism has done for some 8 centuries. I think that we can increase the communication between individuals. I think we can increase the reverence in our church. I think we can intensify the learning of our children by doing it. Hopefully, the other panelists will give their personal experiences to try to give support to those particular ideas.
Raise your hand if you can't.
What is art? One definition that I have here is art is whatever has been considered art for the longest time by the most people who are supposed to know. Maybe a more correct definition may be the creativity of man as distinguished from the world of nature. How can we tell the difference between good or bad art? You've heard it said, or maybe you even said to yourself, I don't know anything, but I know what I like. That statement translates to intellectual understanding of art is not a prerequisite to emotional response. Well, there's no magic formula that one can apply to a work of art to arrive at a fixed rating of its quality. What we see and what we enjoy in a work of art remains in the end a highly personal experience. But it is not possible, for instance, to respond fully to a painting without understanding the means that the artist has used to communicate, such as composition, color, value, texture, line, etc., any more than it is possible to grasp the beauty of Shakespeare without first understanding English. So, one of our first challenges in being able to discern if art is good is to acquire a vocabulary, so to speak, or a better understanding of the means the artist has used to communicate to get more from our aesthetic experiences. Well, what are the characteristics of good or great art, and what are its functions? A popular phrase, art for art's sake, implies that art can exist in a vacuum and can be an escape from life. But I don't believe that's possible. I believe art, good art, is an enrichment of life, and art and living are inseparable and mutually sustaining and always have been since the cave paintings done by early man. For most people that enjoy art without knowing much about it, art's first function is to be pleasing to the eye, or that it bring order to the chaotic material of human experience. This definition is applicable when we test it on the Parthenon, a work of art so perfectly ordered that even in ruins, it is an affirmation that life is a reasonable affair, that its goals can be formulated and achieved, that all confusion and ugliness can be conquered in the creation of ultimate harmony and clarity. But what about Michelangelo's thunderous Last Judgment in the Sistine Chapel, which is all turbulence and terror? Even the martyrs, the saints, and the blessed on their way to paradise seem to share the convulsions of the damned. This scene of universal damnation intensifies our experience of desperation and terror. So maybe the previous definitions of art being pleasing or bringing order don't apply as we might hope. My premise, then, is that the function of art is to clarify, intensify, expand our vision, heighten our awareness, and maybe enable us to see or understand something we didn't before. So how do we know if art is good or even great? Questions such as these may help us decide. Does it divert or deepen our perception? Is it an imitation or an interpretation? Is it a report or a response? Again, a work of art is great to the extent that it enlarges our experience, to the extent that it enriches or clarifies our inner world, not to the extent that it merely echoes the look of the world around us. What is the giver, then, the artist himself or herself? Leonardo da Vinci wrote, "The painter has two objectives, portraying man," here da Vinci refers to the technical skill required by the artist, and revealing the intention of his soul. Da Vinci continues, "The first is easy, the latter hard, because he has to represent it by the movement of the limbs." Well, due to the movements of modern art through the last century, we do now have other avenues of expressing the soul of man other than his limbs. But while technical competency may be learned, an artist needs vision to do great work. Vision not just of the eyes, but of the mind, the heart, and the spirit. What matters most in art cannot be taught. An artist's work is a statement of the virtues or vices he possesses. An artist's work is what he is, no more and no less. Speaking for myself as an artist, it is impossible for me to separate my art and my life. I can only draw from my own experiences for my work. Also, it is impossible for me to separate my life and my religion. And so for me, work, life, and religion are pretty inseparable. When I look at the human form, I feel a witness of beauty, which is a witness of truth. I recognize the witness by comparing it to previous witnesses of other kinds of truth that I've received, and the witness feels the same. To me, this is a religious experience. Or when I make decisions in my work, if I'm true to myself, I work until I feel a sense of rightness about a decision, right for me and right for my work. In my work, I experience a yearning of my soul for truth about myself, others, truth about the human experience of nature, and I feel I find truth when I feel I find truth. For me, it is a religious experience. I probe into my heart and often the heavens to find what insights I can express and share anew. And they will be different from anyone else's because I am different. But that's the beauty of individuality. There's no right or wrong in individual expression. Only different, but maybe someone will be able to grow or identify with my insights. We all know that some of our most growing experiences have been some of our most difficult and painful. The process of becoming may not always be pretty. Then my art may not always be pretty, but I hope will ring with authenticity and truth. As an artist, I may feel outraged by man's inhumanity to man, or I may protest against some other evil. I may feel some things need to be condemned or need an accusation against them. These ideas may be impossible to present in a picture of prettiness. But surely art may present the beautiful, joyous, uplifting side of existence that centuries of great work testify. And in closing, I'd like to quote from Vincent van Gogh. I am always in hope of making a discovery to express the love of two lovers by a marriage of two complementary colors, their mingling and their opposition, the mysterious vibrations of kindred tones, to express the thought of a brow by the radiance of a light tone against a somber background, to express hope by some star, the eagerness of a soul by a sunset radiance.
Well, this is only half of the relief to get up here. I've had fears of when I did arrive, we'd be able to see each other, me behind the podium. I think Shauna is considerably taller than I am, so I was laboring under a delusion here. And I didn't know if I had to stand on the tape recorder or a chair. I don't know which would be better. My topic is a variation of this theme of the session, art as religious experience. Mine is literature, more specifically, poetry as religious experience. Fortunately, this paper comes toward the end of a symposium, and I'm glad for that because much that has gone before has informed or would expand at least this paper, and I can make some of those references to previous things that may help and may help me condense my presentation. Well, one of the main things on the lighter side is for those of you who saw the God Makers, how many of you did that? Well, one of the presenters there. From that experience, you should deduce that Sharon Swenson is the true humorist of this symposium. If you were there, you knew that. Getting perhaps a little heavier, I need to know this one too. How many of you were at the opening plenary session on Wednesday night? Brother Arrington, of course, was. From that, I came to an understanding of why poets are suspect and not to be trusted, and those who enjoy poetry and probably extending to the arts. And that comes, for those of you who weren't there, I'll give a brief description. Both Dr. Shipps and Bushman referred to in our enlightened classification. Magic, myth, and the occult are classified very separately from religion, which is assumed reasonable and rational and worthy of the enlightened response. Now, poetry does include those aspects, but Dr. Bushman mentioned that this other side that poets deal with, among others, is dealing with things potent, the supernatural, the extraordinary, magic and myth, and the occult. Or to quote Elizabeth Bishop, poets deal with dreams, glimpses of the always more successful surrealism of everyday life, unexpected moments of empathy, is it? A peripheral vision of whatever it is one can never really see full face, but seems enormously important. And one of the definitions of religion is a regard for things that are regarding the divine as of utmost and ultimate importance. My objective is to suggest some ways and to show some points of tangency that exist between the poetic and religious experiences. I experience them very much the same. And I do that based, my premises somewhat stems from the belief that the human condition is a common denominator to both the poetic or artistic experience and the religious experience. Now, that would, of course, depend on the personalities, and I guess we should have gone, or should go, to Ridding's presentation of personality types. So I think there's always variations, and I know there would be people who are not amenable to a poetic or artistic experience, but maybe to a religious and vice versa. But my tendency is not to trust them. But that's, I'm sure, not a general statement. There has been some discussion by Dr. Bishop that there seems to be a horizontal and vertical planes. I, when we met, I never did understand that concept, so I have somewhat of a different definition. I did use that picture to relate somewhat to. The most obvious commonality that I see between the poetic experience and the religious experience is language. Language, unlike painting or music, is handled daily by the world of people, including the world of religious people. Religious experience includes, at least in the mind, the verbal or language component, or the verbal, which might be a definition of myth. Language even prescribes or proscribes what the religious experience might be. Linguists, I think, would tell us, but I'm not one. Language, by its very definition, implies the social and communal side of life, or what I would describe as the horizontal, that interpersonal interaction. They are interpersonal. In religion, the Judeo-Christian religion requires communal responsibility. We have in the New Testament, true religion is this, et cetera, to visit. And and that tradition is well attested to. And the poetry, in terms of the religious experience, assumes there is an audience. It does not exist without one, whether it be one person or a deity or a group of persons who would respond. But language has also what I define as the vertical kind of aspect, in that it looks up to the divine or the other or the unknown and implies its existence by a somewhat magical character of language. And to quote a Brazilian poet, Octavio Paz, I think is his name, we have forgotten that poetry, and we could add religious literature or like scriptures, is not only what words say but what is said between them. That which appears and pauses and silences in the shapes of the white spaces, I heard a rabbi say once. Having discussed language as both a vertical, horizontal and vertical possibility, I want to discuss some other dimensions that are shared by both the religious and poetic experience. First, both the religious and poetic experience suggest a technical skill, a learning, a moving from one degree to another. It implies there is a craft, some knowledge to be learned. This is most arguable and obvious, I think, in terms of the poet. They must master the language and the poetic form. But I also see it in the religious experience. And to me, it's terribly obvious, even just in the suggestion of degrees of glory, or in the scripture, whatever degree of intelligence we obtain unto, etc. Or Joseph Smith, you may learn to recognize the spirit by noticing certain things. It implies that we're accumulating knowledge and ability to respond to religious experiences. And one of my favorites that implies there's varying degrees of capabilities and accomplishments is the quote, I think it's in Jeremiah, where Jeremiah is pleading and says, if Moses or Samuel stood before me, yet I wouldn't do this. that implies that Jeremiah had some kind of lower status. So I really think we can't deny that there is an existence of a skill that is necessary. I think we'd have to also say that it's hardly sufficient for a poetic or a religious experience. It might be, but it certainly increases the odds that either the giver or the receiver is going to have a more excellent product. This technical skill or craft may be adequate for making of literary criticism, and it may also be adequate for making of religious formulation, but I don't think it makes the experiences by itself. Another dimension that is shared by both of them, as I mentioned earlier, talk of the otherworldly or the supernatural or the unknown. Maybe they would call it the divine. And if a poet is reluctant to call it that, however, Robert Graves states that the function of poetry is the religious invocation of the muse, but others may not agree. They might use words such as insight or inspiration, the illuminating idea, intuition. Both of these fields of poetry and religion, or writing generally, I think it could extend to prose and fictional writing, consider that there is a sense of importance of the other, of the unknown, and that it is probably of utmost of importance. The terms that I've used so far in this vertical have been affirming and positive, and I appreciate Shauna's bringing up that art does deal with the overworld and the underworld. It can also be negative and talk of negative aspects of life. And this is easily suggested by Jacob's ladder, what ascends must descend. The human condition includes both the affirmative and negative aspects. With regard to the artistic experience in this characteristic, Flannery O'Connor observes, "I don't think you can ask an artist to be affirmative and negative. The human condition includes both in truth and art. In truth, art fastens on one aspect of the world and works through its essence to some essential thing in it and then presents it." But perhaps as a caution, Elizabeth Bishop says in responding to confessional poetry and discussing that, she says, "The tendency is to overdo the morbidity. You just wish they'd keep some of the things to themselves." Regarding this negative aspect in the religious experience, that wilderness, that leap of faith, the mists of darkness, the scriptures are full of those kinds of things, or at least imply a lot of metaphysical, difficult questions. Even just the scripture, "He descended below all things, that he might be in and through all things, the light of truth." Both the people who have previously spoken have alluded to another characteristic that I want to kind of specify and clarify in terms of the poetic experience. And that is the necessity of silence, or being alone, or being the individual, or concentrating. I think the word Dr. Bishop used was pondering, thinking. It has many terms: meditation, contemplation, stillness, maybe waiting, maybe reticence. And from the scriptures we have, "Be still and know that I am God." And then there are other cases that would be represented. The simple injunction, "Hear and listen," in the scriptures suggests attention, concentration, and a focusing, a whole soul turned toward the illuminating light and the knowledge. From the field of literature, again, the Brazilian poet suggests, in poetry workshops of universities, there should be a required course for young poets learning to be silent. And from Elizabeth Bishop, "What one seems to want in art, in experiencing it, is the same thing that is necessary for its creation, a self-forgetful, perfectly useless concentration. Both the poetic and religious experience, in my mind, are most clear and forceful when they avoid sentimentality, and this was brought up in the opening session by both Drs. Bushman and Chip, when specifically Dr. Bushman, when he talked about being concerned about his style of being a lean writer, and I'd just like to support him, that art and as well as religion should concern itself with full emotion or full feeling, not excess emotion. It is best when it is direct, austere, and free from emotional slither. And I think this is one place religion has learned the most, and I think it has a lot to do with focusing and pondering, and the artist should also learn. I think that the greatest overlapping of the religious and poetic experience comes when they inform the paradoxes and the reoccurring theme or concerns. And the main reoccurring theme of both the poet and the religious person is usually life and death and its variations, and those profound questions that arise out of that. A very complete discussion of this paradoxes could be found in Jean England in terms of the religion, and Foster in the last dialogue points out some of the paradoxes and the tensions that exist in the religious experience. As Pasternak has Chivago say, art has two great constraints, two unending concerns. It always meditates on death and thus creates life. All great genuine art resembles and continues the revelation of St. John. And it basically asks the question, what has become of the beloved? One of the paradoxes in art, and is suggested in this dichotomy between religion and myth, and that basically they both shouldn't, is the rational, irrational components of them. And Elizabeth Bishop says, I can't believe we are wholly irrational. But I think Robert Graves, in discussing the poet, which he has earlier described in the Welsh and Irish means seer and priest, compares a good artist or poet to a Hebrew prophet. I presume a good one. If the writer, poet, or we may say prophet, I'm paraphrasing, went into a trance and was afterward unconscious of what he was babbling, that would be an illegitimate case or fairly useless situation. But if he remained in possession of his critical faculties throughout and after, that effect then becomes useful or legitimate. His or her words would have crystallized the immense experience into a single poetic jewel, but the poet still would have remained the sturdy author and regulator of his achievement. Perhaps in the creative mind is the fusion of these opposite ends and of the pole, the rational and the irrational. I think as Dr. England describes, that the ultimate paradox is that between the individual and the community, or the individual responsibility and the communal responsibility. This paradox and its riddles and its realities is the center of both religious and poetic experience. And I have a wonderful quote here in my margin. I hope to get it. The dual nature of the art of poetry is that it has a physical aspect and reminds us of our individuality and our animal privacy, the world of sensations, of visions and appetites. It has an earthiness and brings matter and things back into art. But then its formality and its existence within a language reminds us of our communal dealings. The human single soul on the one side, and on the other, the contingent world of artifacts and other people. And I think when artists deal with this without taking sides, as Brother England says, or without those kinds of responses, is when it is its best, both the religious and the art experience. And Helen Bendler, in speaking of Elizabeth Bishop's work, says that the poet, that she, or poets, I might add, poets generally, put into relief the continuing vibrations of her work between these two frequencies. In another poet, the alteration might seem a debate, but she drifts rather than divides, gazes rather than clasps, and her mind slips through the coarser nets of faction, and in some bewilderment wonders what all the fuss is about between these opposite poles on the paradox. I have a conclusion, hopefully here. My concern that is that we might neglect or ignore our poetic, our artistic experiences, or lose our artists, or our poets, or our musicians. And I think it would be more than to lose that. I think we would simply be out of luck.
I do not think I have ever seen anything more beautiful than the bluebell I have been looking at. I know the beauty of the Lord by it. A poet wrote that in his diary, and in a poem he wrote, "The world is charged with the grandeur of God. It will flame out like shining from shook foil." The poet brings a special sensibility when he looks at the bluebell. He has a capacity of seeing the beauty in it, and is able to express in words the fact that the beauty that he sees in it. And he is acculturated and educated. Somehow he is prepared to be reminded by that beauty of the Lord. This particular poet could mean the physical beauty of Christ as well as something more analogous. We might be moved by the poet's sentence, "I do not think I have ever seen anything more beautiful than the bluebell I have been looking at," and yet we ourselves haven't seen the bluebell at all. We've only read the words. Next time we see a flower, having heard these words, we may look at it differently because of the words. So, among other things, art makes us look at the world and the things in the world, and somehow the things in the world being created by God bear traces of that fact. Somehow the world is charged with the grandeur of God. Art helps us to see the world truly. And if we see the world truly, it reveals not only its own being, but the being behind all being. And the sense that art helps us truly see the world, in the sense that art helps us truly see the world, it has a universal character. A Greek philosopher said, "Those who are awake have a common world, but those who sleep turn aside, each into his own particular world." Art then keeps us awake, awake to the truth of the world. As another philosopher has written, "The indispensability, the vital function of the arts in man's life consists above all in this, that through them the contemplation of the world is kept active and alive." Sometimes we are hungry for music or nature because we are hungry for the reality that they put us in touch with. There is truth in the observation that we owe what we see in nature often to art as much as to nature itself. Having seen paintings of golden aspens by a mountain stream has a lot to do with the beauty we see when we are in the mountains. If we see the grandeur of God in things, it is partly because we have read that the world is charged with the grandeur of God. If we see in things not only a reflection of being itself, but also a relationship to it, it may be because we have read in the Psalms that Yahweh's tenderness embraces all creatures, or "Yahweh, all your creatures thank you." But I think it is wrong to see in this a relativism in this observation only a relativism. In the I'm sorry. I think it's wrong to see in the observation that what we bring to what we see has a lot to do with what we see. Our perception of the world is a chemistry between what we bring and what the world is. The world is inexhaustible because, although it is finite, it hints at being that is infinite, just as because a person is so profound, many relations to the person and perceptions of the person can all be founded on reality. By the same token, we experience works of art differently, just as it is unlikely that you or I, if we were confronted by that particular bluebell, would exclaim, "I do not think I have ever seen anything more beautiful than the bluebell I've been looking at." If somehow we apprehend the real through art, the being itself behind everything, in the words of the Song of Songs, "See where he stands behind our wall," how does that relate to worship? As a group, and I mean the group of us on the panel, when we met together, we had some disagreement about that fact. We've disagreed some on the relationship of the religious experience we have through art to worship. It seems to me that worship and prayer have a tendency to leave things behind, to address God directly. If one senses God behind the wall in nature, sensing that the world is charged with the grandeur of God, and then is carried on to say, "My God, I thank you," or "My God, I love you," it seems to me that at that point one leaves those things behind. They can even become a distraction, and at that point we want to retire to the closet. In apprehending art, even though we may sense God back of it somehow, we pay attention to the work of art. In worship, we pay attention to God. Which leads into the topic of art in church services. In church services, we pay attention to God, and everything else in the service is subservient to that end, including the role of art. In church, we don't want to look at the work of art except out of the corner of our eye. This is not asking too much renunciation of art. Plenty of Catholic masses have been composed using the parts and prayers of that liturgy without changing a word and without complaint. What is art's role in worship services? Perhaps the term sacrifice of praise, which I think is from one of the Psalms, says it. One thinks of the gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh which the Magi brought. Some extravagance as with a wedding gown. They are, as it were, the radiance from the worship. Note that it is the act of worship which gives position and dignity to the arts here. The arts must rise to the occasion. There is no question of the arts making the occasion, or worse, manipulating the emotions of those present. Hopefully, the art is expressing the emotions of those present. Works of art can serve practical purposes like a hymn or a wedding dress or a shaker chair. But the art in them is something you can't or cannot order up. You can order up splendor and pomp, but you cannot order up art. If you commission a composer to set a hymn, you get a serviceable or not serviceable hymn, and you gamble that you get art. It may be art and not be a serviceable hymn, just as roofs on houses by Frank Lloyd Wright might have leaked on occasion. And the hymn might need repair or rejection on practical grounds, just as the roof might need repairing. You cannot harness the art itself, and there are no shortcuts to it. The art itself has a value, but it really has no purpose. It just is. We are happy to have it. There are many sculptures on the outside of Chartres Cathedral. They were meant to teach, but the art, that beautiful something that's more than a textbook diagram, that just is, and you can't order it up. It comes out of man's freedom, and in a way it even comes out of God's freedom, because art is a gift. I would like to mention architecture briefly. I begin by observing that there's not much architecture around, even though there's a lot of building. Art in building is as rare as a photograph which possesses the qualities of art is among the hundreds of photographs we are likely to see in a day. To make a comment, a building in Utah that's as good as any, the Manti Temple. The building seems special and unique. Well, what is it? Partly it's the relation of the building to the site, partly its proportion, partly the physical presence of the materials, the stonework, the woodwork, a kind of magic chemistry. When I mention the stone, it's not just stone, but this particular stone worked by this particular hand. The poet didn't talk about bluebells, but a bluebell. Surely the quality of greatness of the Manti Temple has something to do with the fact that it's a temple and not a grain elevator. When we think of the great buildings, purely utilitarian ones such as forts, warehouses, and grain elevators are not among them. Great buildings are connected to high purposes. I would like to say a word about the role of the architect. In the case of the Manti Temple, Brigham Young selected the site. The plan was given in general. It is similar to other temples of the period, especially Logan. In spite of all this, the architect did exercise his art and a great building resulted, whereas with another architect, the building might not possess its wonderful quality. Or was it luck or providence?
Well, Shauna, I believe in the arts for their own sake. And I've sat there thinking, why? And I guess because they have had to exist for in and of themselves for so long. They've had so little help. But for me, they alone adequately express and communicate the subtleties of feeling and the power of emotion that are so bone and marrow real and yet are never adequately expressed for me in any other way. Great art seems to take the universal unconscious, the longings and perceptions of man, and translates it into a more concrete form. For both the creator and those who come after, it's a process of discovery of self. I know that a work of art is a very personal thing, created always out of faith and love. But through great works of art, I discover that that which is most universal, namely love and the pain of suffering, that is most personal, these two things are also most universal. In his writings, the Apostle Paul repeatedly asks, "Are ye yet asleep? Are ye not awake?" And we all are indeed born into a sleep, and the purpose of the gospel is to awaken us to our real nature, our uncreated eternal possibility. As I come to understand a painting, or to internalize the sound and symbol of a poem, or become kinesthetically aware of an architecturally bound reach of space, I'm alive in a new awareness of what I then discover I already knew. The arts awaken me to myself. Much, if not all, of the arts we are exposed to in a church setting is art in a secondary or subordinate role. We find art to decorate, to illustrate, to smooth the preaching of the gospel to the world. But is literature only of value when it effectively tells a faith-promoting story, or painting and sculpture only as they specifically depict scripture or Mormon history or Mormon ideals, music only when it has words to teach, or architecture only as efficient and pleasant space for programmed activity? Or is a work of art primary, and more importantly, in and of itself, a revelatory experience? I believe very strongly that it is. Art is to be experienced. Much of what I experience in writing music is also what I experience in listening to the music of others. The challenges and rewards for both creator and participator are often the same. And in music, just as in other things, knowledge is always better than ignorance. The experience of creating music is very hard work. It is my communication with a sense of sound, of volume, of thickness, textures, woolly or bright, distance, expansion and contraction, pitch, rhythms of infinite variety, proportion, and flow. It is discovering a musical idea to develop, to nurture. For like life itself, music must grow or it too is dead. I look for potential in the germ idea. I am really looking for personality and for a soul unique, and I must always seek to make it bloom. My craft must be expert in that I already know 1,000 ways in which music may be written, themes fragmented and transformed, motives sprung into fresh configuration. This knowledge gives me the tools for looking at the task, some possible solutions, but most importantly and hopefully the right questions to ask of myself. For the listener, this same knowledge creates expectations which may be oh so satisfyingly fulfilled, or expectations fulfilled in delightfully unexpected and goosebumpy ways. Whatever the way the music goes, it is a unique journey. Every piece is different, and for every work, there's a different story about how it came to be. As with the listener, for me, it's very much a process of discovery. I listen, and I listen, trying to hear things as if they were brand new. And most importantly, I listen to myself as I listen. I probe my sense of the essence of the thing. I write to please myself, but when it is written, I have a great need to share it with someone else who will understand. And I will always remember a friend of mine who is a violinist who was rehearsing to play a string quartet that I had written. And she came to me and said, in a not very refined artistic way, but she said, "You really spilled your guts all over that second movement." And I really had, but for her to know that was a real bonding on some wonderful level between the two of us. And perhaps art is the way that we can bridge our essential loneliness. As I said, art is to be experienced. Sometimes this experience is instant, electric, and I must search to discover the significance that my unconscious has perceived instantly. Sometimes the experience, the emotion, is brought on by intellectual observance. For instance, the incredible architecture and interrelationships that one finds when analyzing a Beethoven sonata. This summer, I have been learning about electronic music composition using a lab up at the university, and I had one of these intellectual thunderclap experiences. Sound is particles moving through the air in wave-like motions, ranging anywhere from a very slow and even motion, which we might interpret as a soft breeze, to all the way to the other side, ultrasound, which is used in medical diagnostic procedures. Our human ear, of course, only hears a certain segment of this range. Musical sounds have very regular wave patterns, while noise waves are very irregular and random and never the same. There's a device in a lab which produces this noise electronically, and believe it or not, there's a switch on this. You can have pink noise or you can have white noise. They both sound, well, let's see, pink noise sounds like the ocean, and white noise sounds like static. And there is another device in the lab which will cut off the tops of this wave, of this noise wave, and make it possible for one to hear just what is above that line. And amazingly enough, this turns out to be music. The melody spills out. And spills out. It is frothy and always changing. The rhythm of the music is created by the spaces between the waves that don't come up above this and this line that is drawn by the machine. And this rhythm, I wish I should have probably brought this for you, is so intriguing and so infectious and so totally involving. It makes you want to really to stand up and try to move with it. And of course, it is always changing, and the melody is always changing. Although I understood the basic physics, I, hope I've got them right, of sound. I didn't know until this experience synthesized it, and this is one of the things that the others have talked about, this synthesis that occurs, that first of all, that there was music, and that I guess God put it there on the top of noise, or that in a sense, for light is wave and particle as well, that all creation might be perceived as dancing and singing in testimony to the glory of God and to the love that went into the creation of the world for us. Art experienced is, for me, a form of worship. It is the manifestation of all that is my immovable faith. It centers me. I can become very alive in all those ways that Bruce so cataloged so well. And yet there is a calmness and a peace too, which the others have spoken of. I can understand these two opposite things that also have been spoken of. For instance, I can understand and accept somehow that life is bittersweet but beautiful. The arts enabled me to see familiar things differently, like entering this valley from a different direction. I can live my little life with my family and friends, but all the while I'm conscious of others living their little lives so like mine and yet so different. The arts synthesize and make whole the disparate parts of life. I see our samenesses and love our differences. I feel the life in plants and animals and in the earth itself. I have glimpses of my stewardship in all of this, profound interconnectedness, interdependence, and love. I want to thank all of the panelists for their fine presentations now and invite them to come up and for them to ask their questions of each other. I think they're all loaded for bear, maybe. Particularly, I think Art brought up some new ideas that perhaps the others of us hadn't thought of, and invite your questions as well. You want to come up? Are there any comments or things you would like to share or questions you'd like to ask? Perhaps I'll take advantage of my position. And Bruce, I'm going to ask you a question about, do you think that there is, should be, or can be a Mormon art?
I definitely think there is such a thing as a Mormon art. I think that if you look historically at art as expressed by great musicians, for example, I'll take Bach as an example, he had one specific purpose in mind, and that was to glorify God as he saw God, as through his particular religion. And his compositions were, in some way, the passions and so on, were to express that particular idea. And if you go back and look at art, look at the paintings in the chapels in Europe, they have a definite flavor of the doctrine of Catholicism. They are expressed through those paintings. And I think that in whichever art we have, they are loaded with bear for that particular biased aspect of that particular creator, that artist. So I think that, as I told one of my music professors at the University of Utah, I said, hey, it's really time that Mormonism puts their propaganda through art. And that's a crude way to put it, but I think that we can do that, and I think that we should do it. Yeah.
Where then are all the great Mormon artists? If you look at the music art, you don't
that, but let me just make one comment about that before I sit down. If you have a religion that is very authoritarian, which Mormonism is, it's by nature very restrictive and makes decisions not only about theology, but it makes decisions about other areas, and art happens to be one that they've made decisions on. I don't know how... Well, I think there will be great Mormon artists. I think that if it is recognized that art and the religious experience are very compatible, that hopefully sometime that the church will begin to commission people to create things, that we eventually will be able to encourage our kids to play their Suzuki violins in sacrament meeting, or whatever other way that we do it to try to get them to express themselves, that through people such as the panel members, that we'll be able to have some type of grassroots experience to encourage things in Mormonism. You know, on the east side several years ago, there was, maybe you know this, Helen, which area this was, one ward had a whole symphony orchestra. That was a grassroots experience. I don't think it's going to come from the top. I think people that like us that have had experiences in art must express it. Well, Shona and Marianne talk about the problem of art being good and bad, and how you express it.
You know, I think the Mormon people are innate, basic talent, as talented can be, but I'm sure there are a lot of issues here, but just a couple I just jot down, and I probably, you know, I hope my anger doesn't come through too much. One problem, as I see it, is that of commitment. You know, when I hear, where are all the great Mormon artists, and the kind of commitment to be great in anything is an amazing commitment. It almost has to be first in your life. Now, that doesn't mean God can't come first, but could we regard art as a service? You know, I don't know. I've often thought if artists could receive callings, you know, that they wouldn't feel so pulled in so many directions if they could focus and if they could concentrate. I think that's one issue is. In the Mormon culture, we're not allowed to make that kind of a commitment without, to me, it seems that it appears somewhat selfish to do that. Another thing is I think that great art takes a lot of desire to explore for truth, and I think too many of us, maybe not us, but when you're given all the answers and your desire or even maybe your innate quest for truth is cut off by saying, you know, we have all the answers, we have all the truth, and to ask or to doubt or to... So I think part of that truth seeking or desire for insight, when we're just told what to believe and what to think, I think cuts off that yearning to find answers anew. Those are just, I, you know, could probably go on, but maybe those are just a couple. Do you want to
say something? I'd like to make a comment. I heard Ardeen Watts give a very interesting talk, Is There a Mormon Art, at the Institute several years ago, and I know that everyone on the stand expected him to say, yes, there is, and he said, no, there isn't. And the discouraging part of his talk was, mostly, was to me that there never would be, because of something that Shauna mentioned, that with us, God comes first, our families come second, our church comes third, and then the art, and it just, that kind of thing doesn't preclude that we're going to have any great art. And also, something along with what Shauna said, I think great art needs great audience. More questions? Yes, the gentleman right here.
Yes, I'd like to address that last question.
Okay, why don't you stand up?
I want to talk about one of the big problems that we have in the community. We talk a lot about communication, where the artist can create the work of art out of some religious experience or response to the natural world we go. The problem is the congregation community, our congregation transferring that experience to the congregation.
the level where the creative mind is functioning, and is it possible to connect?
I think I'm an optimist at heart, so hope that the human condition should make us very complex and should raise us above, in my mind, that the material should be there in the people, is what I'm saying, to have a great audience, as Shauna suggested. I guess I could go ask President Kimball, who's in no condition to respond, probably. Would he say something that we do expand our vision or our confidence in ourselves? I see it as a function of confidence. But in lieu of that, and it's hard to get past the secretaries, I think I see it as me demanding that when I teach classes or making comments, that I don't hide that light under a bushel, not particularly my light, the artist's light, that you don't let cliche go by, or the simple, or the insipid, that people we're with are ready for that. And I think, like Shauna said, I don't wait. Perhaps it does require some communal support, but I think you can't wait for the community to say, we want this and we'll support it financially, support the great artist. Or to assume, just because somebody thinks it's all so simple and they're telling us that all of it, I think there's a lot has been mentioned at this symposium that there is a lot of room in the Mormon Church in terms of doctrine and dogma. It hasn't been systematized, and even if it were, there's still a lot of searching that we don't ask permission to do, the searching, to ask the questions, to make the artistic and creative flight. And I've seen it done by both those with their left brains and their right brains, and I hope we all continue to do that without asking permission.
Let me just respond to his comment. First of all, I agree with you that people have different needs. I had a friend once that I asked him what he ever saw in football, because I don't see anything in football. And he says, oh, you've never seen anything so poetic as someone catching a ball in the end zone. And it brought an opening eye to me that I thought, oh my gosh, there is something there. But in response to why we should push the arts, Willie Sutton was once asked, why robs banks? And he says, well, I rob banks because that's where the money is. And we propose that where the money is in spiritual realms is in the arts. And to me, what we ought to do to encourage an audience that would receive the arts is start expanding some of the ideas that have happened in Mormonism, such as delivering cultural arts to more than just women. We ought to start delivering to men. I used to go to the Relief Society meeting because that's where the good spirit was, until I made all the ladies uncomfortable because I resented that the priesthood couldn't be able to be educated in the arts. I think that we can educate people in the arts, and we can begin in the grassroots level and overcome the problem which Helen suggested, that there's an audience that has to be cultivated as much as artists. I think our time is through.
Thank you very much.